Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News on the day after the election. This hour, what voters said and what it means.
I want to start off by just saying that tonight was an incredible night for democracy.
We've spent 2 years waiting for someone to stand up to the partisanship and the division in Washington.
You believed in us when all the pundits didn't. When they said there was no way we could take this race on and give North Texas the real leadership that it deserves.
So let's celebrate here tonight, knowing that tomorrow our work really begins.
Congressional Democrats woke up in Washington this morning in a position that they haven't held since 2010, way back in the midst of President Obama's first term. As of January, Democrats will now hold the Speaker's gavel and the majority in the U.S. House of Representatives. Democrats also hold more governor's seats than they have since President Obama was in office, and Republicans broadened their support in the Senate. Here are some of the trends that we're going to talk about this morning and that I hope you'll think about as you join the conversation and call in. Women. Women turned out as voters in huge numbers and won as candidates in unprecedented numbers. Military vets. At least six of the women who won seats in the House last night were military veterans, including Mikey Sherrill in New Jersey and Chrissy Houlihan in Pennsylvania. Suburbs versus rural, America's battleground for this election, and the next one in 2020 will be fought in the suburbs, which are growing, and the rural areas, which are shrinking, but still highly influential. And the Midwest is changing again. Midwestern voters were the key to many of these trends, and we're going to talk about why. As our guests join in, I hope you will too. If you're a voter who lives in the suburbs in our region of the country, what did you vote on, and how are you seeing the results? If you live in rural Iowa, Wisconsin, or Minnesota, what did you vote on and how do you see the results? So I want to hear from voters in the suburbs. I want to hear from voters in rural parts of the upper Midwest here as we begin our conversation. What did you vote on? How are you seeing these results? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, wherever you are in the upper Midwest, and on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. Our guest, Niambi Carter, is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Howard University, and she's with us today in Washington, D.C., a pretty changed Washington. Niambi, welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Melissa Michelson is with us. She's Professor of Political Science at Menlo College in California. We haven't even mentioned California, and I will get to that. Melissa, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks.
So, Niambi, does the result in the House mean that Democrats' closing argument on health care and taxes, and we'll talk about immigration separately here in a minute, ended up winning the day? Or was it really all about a president who kept saying, pretend I'm on the ballot, and that worked in some places, and people voted against that in other places? How do you assess that?
Well, I mean, I think it's definitely a mixed bag. I think when you have candidates, particularly candidates of color, it's a lot easier to win in districts than it is to win in states, primarily because those folks don't often carry the majority in states like New York or Illinois, even in places like Maryland with large minority populations, but they don't actually carry the whole state. But I do think it was a mixed bag. I do think the House being sort of always sort of designed to be the sort of people's chamber, really shone through with the election results we saw yesterday.
So Melissa, here's my question about what Niambi just said about the House. Is the House, do you think, more representative of Americans who are, and more of us are, living in suburbs? And are we seeing the rural America effect more in the Senate? How's that playing out?
Well, I think there's a lot of things going on between the differences in the House and the Senate. Part of it is that there are just smaller districts in the House, and so the elections are more about the specific characteristics of each district, whereas in the Senate, I mean, some of these states, not just California, but a lot of states in the United States are so diverse that you can't really get a large voice for any particular population in a state. Right, because it's a whole statewide election.
Right.
I wouldn't say that it's a rural versus urban divide. I'd say it's more about just the way the two chambers are designed and the way that the rules are written affect what happens in those two chambers elections.
We definitely see this suburban rural trend here in the upper Midwest. Do you see that, Melissa, in California?
Absolutely, in California. I mean, we are a state of contrasts. What you see when you look at our map is the coastal area is very blue, and the inland empire and the more eastern parts of the state, and especially the northern end, are bright red. And so even in a wave election, there are still very safe Republican areas of California, and you see that consistently in our election results.
We have a lot of voters on the line that want to talk. Let's go to Nicole in Eden Prairie. So, Nicole, you're one of those suburban women that we're going to be talking about today. What were you thinking about?
Well, I know after Trump was elected, several friends and I, we really got much more active than we had ever been. I mean, I finally figured out how to call my congressperson. I put them on speed dial. I would call Eric Paulson at least once a week. I feel like his staff got to know me. But the issues that really drove us were guns, just all of the school shootings. It just really has become very real. And healthcare, you know, when healthcare was at risk, for the first time ever, I made signs. They were in my trunk. You know, I went and stood on a corner outside Eric Paulson's office. So this election really got me to get off my butt and just, you know, take things into my own hands and realize that I have a responsibility to do something.
Hey, thanks for the call, Nicole. You bring up Eric Paulson and Niambi. His district was changing demographically kind of around him. And now we hear Nicole, as I think somewhat representative of that, will we find other members of the House who lost their races, perhaps in some of these urban suburban districts that ran into the same thing?
I think so, especially because if we've looked at the suburbs and the composition of the suburbs, suburbs are becoming more diverse spaces, whether that is Houston, right, or the suburbs of Washington, D.C. A lot of these places are becoming, if not majority minority, at least a plurality minority. And I do think that actually does matter. But I take Professor Mickelson's point that it will depend on what state you're talking about, because these are not monolithic places. But I do at least say if we're looking at the trends, suburbs are becoming very different than they were. It used to be that, you know, suburbs were white and the cities were not. And that's not true anymore, in part because of the housing crisis in some places, like in this particular region, in the D.C. region, where lots of folks found themselves affected by the mortgage crisis and the cost of living in cities just kind of grows at an exponential rate. Suburbs have become refuges for Latino and Black folks in this particular region. So I definitely think it matters.
Okay, so that's really interesting. And you just talked to us about how housing is affecting that trend. What about education? What about decisions made about schools and quality of education? Would that be contributing to that as well?
I think so. I mean, if you're living in the District of Columbia and you've paid, you know, maybe $500,000 for a house, and you also have to then think about tuition for private schools, I absolutely think that drives some people, because if you're not particularly well-resourced, Montgomery County becomes much more attractive. It's adjacent to the city, but their schools are better in some locations. So I definitely think that has to be part of the narrative, particularly as people are thinking about how their dollars stretch in states that have higher costs of living, like New York or, I'm certain, California. People have to make choices about the lives that they can lead, and suburbs become a place that allow people to provide a home and a decent schooling without the additional cost of a private school education.
On Twitter, a listener says, I'm a moderate conservative in Eden Prairie that voted mostly Democratic to keep Trump's beliefs out of Minnesota. Eric Paulson's support of the ill-thought-out tax reform didn't help either. Hey, Melissa, let me linger on that for a moment. Did tax reform seemed like there was a lot of talk about immigration and health care. They passed a big tax reform bill. Did that end up being influential, do you think?
I don't think it did because folks weren't talking about it. It was certainly in the background and the good economic news that's been coming out about low unemployment rate and rising jobs. That definitely helps the incumbent party, the Republican Party. But it wasn't the issue that folks were talking about. It wasn't what Trump was talking about. They were talking about health care. They were talking about immigration, the migrant caravan. So maybe it was on some folks' mind, but it really wasn't an issue that was being highlighted by most of the campaigns.
To the phones to Robin in Huxley, Iowa. Hey, Robin, hi.
Hello.
Hi. What did you want to talk about?
I wanted to talk about Steve King.
Okay.
He represents our 4th district here in Iowa.
Yes.
And I'm kind of like Nicole, the first caller, where I have taken action the last 2 years of doing a lot of calls, and I really supported his opponent in this race. And his opponent was just so, like, normal, down-to-earth, Midwestern, and my issues were probably water and environment and, you know, agricultural things. And, you know, this guy seemed to have it all, but he just couldn't get past Steve King. And it just is so heartbreaking.
So, Robin, just so I understand this, your district sounds largely rural. Is that right?
It is, right. And I live down by Ames and Des Moines. So we live in a rural town, but it's so close to the bigger cities. And I'm a Democrat. And, you know, we have this county carried as a Democratic county here. So.
All right. Did you happen to see the breakdown between women and men voters in the district?
I did not.
Yeah, it might be a little too soon for that. Good to have your call. I wanted to ask you about this, Melissa, that we were seeing research that showed that college-educated white suburban women were leaning Democratic, although they were not the reliable source of votes that Hillary Clinton thought they would be. How did it turn out, especially in some of these other states where it looks like a lot of women turned out to vote for, you know, the governor's race in Georgia and the governor's race in Florida? What do we now understand about where women went?
I think we need to talk about women as partisans and to not assume that women are a monolithic block, right? Women don't vote together. White women are still supporting the Republican Party, and women of color are tending to support the Democratic candidates. And so, you know, we talk a lot these days about identity politics and about how we're breaking up into groups, Latino voters over here, black voters over here.
Right.
But you can't talk about women that way because they really are divided by party.
And yet, I want to say, Naomi, that I see women supported pushing the Republican out in some of these Virginia races and bringing women Democrats in. We saw this in Kansas. I mean, in some districts, white suburban women were going for Democrats, just as I guess what Melissa's saying. Mm-hmm. And in some other places, some other states, they were stepping back and it was the women of color that were really influential in those suburban races. What'd you see?
Well, I mean, I think it's as Melissa stated. I mean, I think the idea that there's something innate about women that will bond all women and cause them to vote the same way.
No, absolutely not.
Thing, you know, right. Just doesn't hold. And I think the thing about white women in particular is that they're more often the defectors. Right. So if we're talking about this collection of people who seem to have similar interests and should be voting in their best interest, white women see their interests differently. And that does break down along party lines. And so why that happens, I don't think we fully know yet. Partisanship is part of the answer, but it may also be about how they think about their gender and what that means for their politics. We don't know yet.
Niambi, just to, not to interrupt here, but I just had a conversation with Rebecca Traister. We're going to play that discussion in about a week or so. She's got theories about how women, white women, are invested in the structures of, you know, maintaining the current structures of power. I mean, I'm really distilling what she says about this, but it's pretty interesting. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think the work done by political scientists Lori Fraser Yoakley and Jane Jun to a certain extent bear out that point, which is that white women look a lot like white men in terms of how they make electoral decisions. Now, the idea that white women somehow don't derive any benefits from patriarchy and have not been part of white supremacist projects, I think, is part of the reason why that concept might be difficult for some people to grasp. It's like, of course they're women and patriarchy is bad for them until patriarchy isn't, right? And there are moments where white women derive, if nothing else, a psychic benefit, perhaps from being allied with white maleness. White male patriarchy, to be more specific. And it's not to say that people are bad people for making those choices. I think those choices are very much sort of ingrained.
They're
in
complicated.
How,
yeah,
it is very complicated.
Right.
It's very complicated. But I want to be clear, this doesn't necessarily make people bad people, but people are making the decisions that they make based on sort of what is best for them. And that may not include other people.
Yeah. I mean, in a lot of those decisions, Melissa, that voters across the board, right, we know that there's some pretty complicated psychology and social conditioning that goes into the idea of how we vote, why we vote. I'm interested in your thoughts about how white women are breaking in different ways and in different states. What's it look like in California? Maybe I should ask that.
Well, California definitely is a blue state, and women, including white women, tend to vote Democrat around here. But again, it depends on which part of the state you're in. Mm. So if you're in, say, the more agricultural areas of the Central Valley, you're more worried about making sure that there's water to keep the economy going. You're concerned about the same issues that Donald Trump has been talking about, and you're a little bit worried about how these progressive Democrats are pushing the Democratic Party and maybe pushing the state to the left. And so there's resistance to that. And so, you know, we can't give clean answers, because women in California, just like Niambi said, women all over, it's complicated, and it depends. And if you're in a red district and you're worried about your kids' education and you're worried about the economy and your job, then you very well might vote Republican and not necessarily feel like, because of your gender, that you need to be voting along with the pink wave.
Melissa Michelson's one of our guests, if you just tuned in, for our special coverage on the day after the election. She's a professor of political science at Menlo College, with us from Palo Alto, California. Niambi Carter is with us, an assistant professor of political science at Howard University, with us from D.C. And Philip Chen is going to join us a little later from Beloit College in Wisconsin, because big changes up here in Minnesota and Wisconsin. And we're talking about how the Midwest voted and what voters here said and how that compares to trends that we see from the election. 651-227-6000 to talk to me this morning. Whether you're a voter who lives in the suburbs, how did you vote? What was uppermost in your mind? What do you think about the results? If you live in rural Iowa, Wisconsin, Minnesota, wherever we broadcast to up here in the upper Midwest, I'd also like to hear your views on this. How did you vote? What was the motivating issue for you, and how do you see these results? 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. You know, I'd especially like to hear from some voters in Wisconsin. We kind of get deeper into Wisconsin there. It'd be nice to hear your thoughts on this. And on Twitter, at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. Let me go to Jennifer in Hudson, Wisconsin. Hey, Jennifer. Hi.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you on the line. What are you thinking about?
Well, when I went out and voted yesterday, I voted mainly over two topics. One is over the gubernatorial race with Scott Walker and Tony Evers. I was really alarmed and disappointed when Foxconn was brought to Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
And we have the issue of being radically just unconcerned in our government, apparently, with natural resources.
Mm-hmm.
I live just right outside of Hudson. I grew up outside of Menominee, Wisconsin, and I very much value and want to conserve our natural resources. So I'm really hoping now for a change with the turnover of our governor, and also with I have two college-age children, and I was not pleased with, you know, what Governor Walker did with the UW system. Both my children are in the UW system, so that was another
funding for higher education. Jennifer, just a moment before you leave there. You brought up the Foxconn issue. That was a big deal to voters in Wisconsin. And one of the things that Scott Walker had to overcome was this perception that the economy in Wisconsin has not been, and job growth has not been as strong over, I think, the last decade as it has been here in Minnesota. You were not persuaded that Foxconn was gonna turn that around in any way.
No, not whatsoever. I followed it fairly closely, both, you know, on NPR and different news sources. And just, it sounded like Foxconn's track record just wasn't great with, you know, saying, you know, they're going to bring all these jobs, but are they jobs for Wisconsinites? Or
okay.
Are they going to be bringing in folks from outside of our state, outside of our country? Who knows?
Good to have your call, and thanks for the insight on that. Niambi and Melissa, I want to ask you about the economy. Really great economy. We just had good jobs numbers. The president didn't really want to talk about that much, but are we going to, when we start to break down the exit polling, are we going to see that that ended up being pretty influential in hanging on to the Senate, holding some of these governor's seats? Niambi, what do you think?
It may. I agree with Melissa that to a certain extent we didn't hear a lot about the economy. I know for the races that I was paying close attention to, a lot of it came down to education, immigration, which played heavily in healthcare. So we didn't hear a lot about economy. I think it couldn't have hurt that the new jobs numbers came out right ahead of the election. But I don't know if that's on people's minds because I'm not certain that people know how to put those national numbers together with their personal experience.
Meaning that their personal experiences do not feel as strong as the economy looks.
Well, they could. They could not. I'm not certain that people see that their personal circumstances, whether good or ill, are how they are related to these national jobs numbers.
That's kind of puzzling, isn't it, Melissa? How do you see it?
Well, no, I think what Niambi is saying is spot on because, yes, the economy overall is doing well. The jobs numbers look really good, but it does matter how people are feeling. It's not just whether they think the economy is doing well, but whether they think they're doing well. How's their family doing? And there's a lot of diversity there in terms of how rural areas are doing versus cities, in terms of how communities of color are doing. And so I think when we talk about a strong economy, yeah, that matters, but what really matters to people is how much money they've got left in their bank accounts at the end of the month.
Bailey says on Twitter, I live in a county that overwhelmingly went red, but I went blue because I side with more issues such as gun control, immigration, and education. It's nice to know that the majority of Minnesota agrees with me. Meg says, I'm a white suburban mom. I voted for strong, smart, and decent women who care about the environment, equality, health care, and education. Niambi, are you surprised how many voters are calling to talk about the environment? Because, boy, that didn't get any campaign trail discussion at a national level. It did around here. What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, I think this idea that the environment isn't on people's minds has been shown time and time again to not be true. I mean, we're still talking about all this other stuff, and Flint, Michigan still doesn't have clean water.
Right.
So I think that probably matters a lot more in the Midwest and other places where people have seen, you know, oil spills and other kinds of natural disasters that we don't really have a good answer for how we're going to fix it. And people's lives are at stake, and I don't think it's a woman's only issue. But for sure, I think if we think about care work and who does the bulk of care work in some families, that does break down to women. And you have to be concerned with, you know, the air that your children breathe and the water that they're drinking and that you're breathing and that your community is faced with. So I'm not surprised that the environment matters, and it probably matters in some regions more than it does in others.
I'm still going to talk about health care here in a minute, but I'll go to Trevor in Mankato. Hi, Trevor. Thanks for waiting.
Hey. I know with me and Mankato, I know 6 years ago I used to be able to vote Democrat on the federal level, but then when it came to the local level, I'd kind of split it between Democrats and Republicans,
uh-huh,
just kind of based on what the candidate had to say.
Right.
But I know these last two elections, and especially this one, just because of the social issues that we're seeing from Donald Trump and just the GOP establishment in general, I just couldn't bring myself to vote for any of them, regardless of my thoughts on what they were for with, you know, schooling or the economy.
So Donald Trump, President Trump, was really the overlying motivator for your decisions, even on some of these individual races, the local races.
Absolutely. I know a couple of years ago I was helping a friend of mine who was running for Minnesota House in rural Minnesota, and just hearing kind of even how some of those voters there were reacting to Donald Trump and how they were really taking up just kind of his, you know, nationalist stances blew me away. You know, I've primarily been from Minneapolis and, you know, Mankato my whole life, so mm-hmm. I was kind of amazed by what I was hearing when I was out in rural Minnesota.
All right. Good to have the call. Thanks for waiting to chat with us. To Chris in Avon, Minnesota. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Tell me about you.
Well, I'm a white woman, liberal, and of course, when Trump was elected, I was extremely disheartened, and I started working really hard. I'm primarily interested in immigration issues. I have two daughters who are immigrants.
Uh-huh.
And there's been a lot of hate in central Minnesota toward Somalis and toward the Hispanic community. And so I started working with organizations, local organizations, to elect people in our community who would help our immigrant people. I worked really hard on Jim Reed's campaign in 13A and was really disheartened when he didn't win, because he worked his butt off knocking on doors, talking to people, and he had a huge organization of committed volunteers.
Yeah, Chris,
and yet,
I know the result of that. If I may, you've brought up a really good issue, too. I have not yet talked about immigration, and I haven't yet talked about health care. So why don't we get a look at the latest news? And when we come back, we'll talk with Niambi Carter and Melissa Michelson about two of the issues that we thought were going to be highly motivating for voters, and we'll ask them whether they were. Phil Chen is also going to join us from Beloit College in Wisconsin lots of changes in Wisconsin. Really interesting here in the midterm. Niambi Carter with us from Howard University, Melissa Michelson with us from Menlo College. I want to talk to you both about immigration. Check my facts on this. It looks like President Trump's anti-immigration rhetoric did not play well in purple districts, but it played well in pretty solid red districts. Melissa, what did you see?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think if you just look at what happened in the Midwest, you can see those results. A caller earlier was talking about Steve King holding on to his seat. But Iowa flipped two seats to the Democrats. Minnesota, Michigan flipping seats to the Democrats. So in areas of the state, in certain areas of these Midwest states, we're seeing some flips, and I think immigration is part of that, because even though, you know, it's maybe not as much of an issue for folks in the upper Midwest as it is compared to those of us down here in the border states, mm-hmm. it's part of that national message that Trump was pushing is, this is what the election is about.
Niambi, we hear so much that it's all about the president's base, and this plays really well in the president's base. But the president has to also be looking, or his strategists have to be looking at some of these purple areas, Wisconsin, Iowa, Minnesota. These are states that he didn't win Minnesota, but he came close, that he's going to need again in 2020. I mean, what's the strategy here, or isn't there one? He just talks about what he cares about and what he thinks.
Well, I mean, I think their strategy in a lot of places has been voter suppression.
Really?
I mean,
and keep people home.
Absolutely. I mean, I think if we see what's happening in Georgia, we see what's happened in Florida, we see even what happened in Wisconsin in 2016. I think voter suppression has been a key part of what these folks have been about. So I'm not sure what their strategy is going to be in those places, but I cannot imagine that they are going to move away from this polarizing language in any way. I think, in fact, they're going to probably double down on it. And I don't think these attempts to block voters will stop. I think they will continue. And so I think if we are having this discussion about all of these issues, we cannot have this discussion without having a discussion about the structural inequalities that are built in some of these races that we are seeing.
I mean, if this was a policy debate, and sometimes it is a policy debate, mm-hmm. without all the demagoguery and the meanness, that would be something. But that's not how it is.
Not at this particular moment, no. Unfortunately, this is what we have. But I do think it'll be interesting to see how Democrats, now that they are going to control the House, how they're going to talk about this issue.
Right.
I do think that will be an important tone-setting moment. But we'll see how it plays out. I think they'll block a lot of his efforts in the House to become a more stringent immigration regime. But what that language looks like and how that debate is had, I think, will also be important.
I mean, Melissa, the thing we know is that immigration reform would have passed if the House wasn't going along with the Hastert rule, right? There were enough votes for immigration reform. I don't know
enough votes for it, and we saw President Trump saying that he was for it.
That's right, exactly right.
I think that's one of the issues that Nancy Pelosi is hoping that she can find some cooperation with the White House on, that maybe if Trump is for it and maybe if he can bring along enough Republicans, she's certainly able to deliver the votes in the now democratically controlled House. Maybe immigration is something that we'll see some movement on.
Okay, so that's interesting, because in some ways you're saying, you know, can we put the rhetoric that he uses on immigration over here and look at what he might seriously be interested in when it comes to policy? And they may be two different things.
Absolutely. And I think it's important to remember that a lot of the rhetoric was about mobilizing the base and getting folks out to vote. But members of both political parties who are running industries, who are involved in big business, understand that immigration reform is crucial to the long-term health of the economy, to making sure that there are enough workers to fill the jobs that need to get done in the United States. And so if something isn't done about immigration to allow us to continue a strong economy, that's going to hurt both political parties, and that's going to certainly hurt Trump's chances for reelection.
And Melissa, I know you see this in California, right?
We've got labor shortages.
Exactly.
Part of
Same
our housing
here.
Crisis is due to labor shortages in construction.
Exactly.
We've got
right.
crops rotting in the field because of labor shortages in agriculture. I imagine that's also true in the Midwest. We need to do something about the tone of the immigration debate and the nature of immigration policy, for the health of America's economy.
I don't want to miss health care here. Let me talk to Tara in Reidsville. Hi, Tara. Thanks so much for waiting. You are thinking about health care. Is that right?
Yep. That was my main priority. I have stage 4 breast cancer. Mm. I was diagnosed 2 years ago today.
Wow. And, I'm sorry.
Well, I'm fighting hard, So healthcare has been my number one priority since my diagnosis, and I just felt that the Democratic Party, I see more happening backing them than I do the Republican Party. And so that was my main drive when I went to vote yesterday. But my other comment I wanted to make was, while I was standing there looking at my ballot, I was just pleasantly overwhelmed by how many women were on the ballot.
Yeah.
And it felt so good. And then to hear that over 100 women were elected to the House, like, that is just amazing to me. Like, I feel so good today. I just feel like, okay, we're on the right track again. Okay. Everything's going to be okay now.
Good to have your call. And I'm really glad you raised healthcare here, because, Niambi, I want to play an ad that ran in I think it goes right to what Tara was actually talking about, that ran in our governor's race on healthcare. Listen to this.
Okay. I was diagnosed with cervical cancer in 2015. My world had stopped. I thank God I had insurance, because I don't know what we would have done.
300,000 Minnesotans will lose their health insurance under Jeff Johnson. And insurance companies could deny coverage for those with pre-existing conditions.
Okay, so the Republican in the candidate, Jeff Johnson, or in that race, ended up not prevailing. And I don't know if health care was a key part of that. That is how Democrats in our part of the country were talking about health care. Niambi, how important do you think health care was in general to the results that we see?
Oh, I think it was very important. I mean, the Pew Research Center just put out a study just ahead of the midterms, and that was the single most important issue. 9 out of 10 Democrats favored health care reform, and 6 out of 10 Republicans favored health care reform. So that's something I think people can coalesce around. I do think that is an issue that that lots of folks respond to because it is such a basic need. You know, people say, you know, your health is your wealth, and I think that's really important because it's something, health care is something, God forbid, that you don't need until you need it, and you want it to be there, particularly if you're dealing with something that is catastrophic like cancer or some other kind of illness. And the idea that you may be responsible for out-of-pocket costs that are in the hundreds of thousands, even into the millions of dollars over the course of your care, I don't think most people can fathom that. And I think for many, it feels cruel and particularly unnecessary when we know we have the apparatus to create a healthcare system that would work for all people.
Niambi, Melissa, thank you so much. I hope you'll both come back. I hope you'll have time for us again. Really good to have your views and your insight.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Turning now to Philip Chen. He's an assistant professor of political science at Beloit College, with us from Beloit, Wisconsin. And Phil, welcome. Good to have you on the show. I know we've switched times on you a couple times this morning. So
that's
thanks.
Okay.
Thank you for being flexible.
Of course.
I'm going to get to some of these issues that we've talked about in a minute. I want to know overall what you make of what happened in Wisconsin and how it fits to the overall national trend.
I mean, I think what we saw in Wisconsin is exactly what we've been seeing nationally. These are that midterm elections more and more are becoming nationalized elections. And you see what happens with, you know, Wisconsin is was a swing state, a close state in 2016, and it was a close state in 2018. We saw this across the country. I think what does kind of set us apart is the success of Tammy Baldwin compared to other Democratic senators running for re-election in states won by Donald Trump.
Right.
So she sort of cruised to victory here compared to, you know, Joe Donnelly or Claire McCaskill or Heidi Heitkamp, who all are going to end up losing their races.
So I'm curious about how much you think Scott Walker's loss was really about going for a third term. That's a hard thing for any incumbent. Or was it some of the influence of what we've been talking about this morning, what you've just said?
I think to some extent that you have to factor in the fundamentals of going for a third term is difficult. I think if you were looking, you know, there obviously that had to have played a role because the turnout for something like the state house races and the Senate race was higher for Democrats, and yet there was so there's some either vote switching or
ballot
splitting or something
like
that.
Yeah, yeah.
But then again, I mean, I think that Walker ran a race that focused on what he had done in the state. So he tried to remove some of that national aspect to it, and only use Trump as in areas where he thought it might deliver for him, especially northern Wisconsin. It turns out that those were some of the counties, some of those Obama-Trump counties that swung back to Democrats this year.
I know. You see, you can imagine Scott Walker looking into some of those counties and thinking, well, they went for Trump. They're receptive to this kind of message. But Walker having a difficult time kind of walking that line, right, between all in on Trump and still talking about some of the things that turn some of those voters off about the president. He didn't manage to do that, I guess, in the end.
Exactly. I mean, so I think he had a really difficult, like you said, line to walk because he was, you know, for Democrats were going to feel like this was a nationalized election. And so, you know, we see that a lot in the exit polls that individuals who felt that this was a referendum on, you know, their views of Donald Trump definitely went toward, for those who opposed Donald Trump, went for Democrats very, very strongly. And so he was fighting both a Democratic sort of nationalized race and couldn't, I think, walk that line between running a nationalized Republican race and still trying to talk about his accomplishments over the last few terms.
We got a call, and I was hoping to get to Tens in Blaine, but we couldn't get there quite soon enough. She says first-generation immigrant woman, and she voted for the rights of people of color. She felt like there were people on her ticket who supported what she wanted. Phil, I was aware of how immigration was being discussed in the Minnesota campaigns. I was not aware of what was happening in Wisconsin about it. How was it being debated?
So I think you saw a little, I mean, you see some of this as a, in some areas of rural Wisconsin where it's brought up as kind of a sort of an abstract issue. But really the major issues in the gubernatorial race were things like education and healthcare, and those and to the extent that that Evers was able to make the race about those things, I think that's what, you know, he was able to frame the election more around these issues where he was particularly strong, especially on something like education as the state superintendent.
You know, education, we have heard voters saying, I was today and in some of our other shows, this is something that's a priority for me.
Mm-hmm.
What's real, but it doesn't tend to rise at this in this midterm to the top, you know, above health care, et cetera. What's interesting about that, though, is the dynamic in Wisconsin, right? The big, epic battles about education, funding higher education, teachers' unions, et cetera. I mean, that is something that it seems like was unique to Wisconsin in some ways this time. How do you see it?
I think it was unique to Wisconsin, and it's unique to Scott Walker. I mean, Scott Walker had made this, you know, early on in his tenure as governor, made sort of fighting unions and fighting especially the teachers union a key part of sort of what his identity was. And of course he's evolved since then, but that has remained a part of the sort of image of Scott Walker. And so there was a really strong juxtaposition between Walker and Evers on this issue, and I think, like you said, education is a tricky issue because it's not, you know, nobody says they are against education,
exactly.
Right? It's not sort of a typical what we think of as like a wedge issue. There's a lot of nuance to it, and in some sense, Walker made it a wedge issue when he started to go after unions. He tied education, especially teachers' unions, in with this and made it sort of a yes-no kind
right.
of issue.
You know what's interesting about that is that really worked for him on – I mean, think about the – were you in Wisconsin at the recall point?
No,
I don't think you were.
I was in Minnesota then.
Yeah, so you've witnessed all this. But, I mean, so that really worked for him on the recall.
Yeah.
It's interesting that it is one of maybe the key things that took him down this time.
You know, and I'm not, I think it's too early to know. We haven't looked to know if that's what took him down. It could in fact have helped him in this. I mean, it could be the reason that he didn't lose by more to someone. You know, if you look at how Tammy Baldwin did, you can say, well, why did he do so poorly? But you can also say, well, what is it that kept him from losing even, you know, by an even greater
at the
margin.
Rate, yes, at the rate that her opponent lost to, right, Vukmir. A call here from Marsha in Solon Springs. Hey, Marsha, hi.
Good morning.
What was the issue that was really motivating you?
Well, health care for one, but
okay.
Just quickly on Scott Walker.
Mm-hmm.
He torched education. He torched labor. He torched health care in Wisconsin by refusing Medicaid dollars and addiction counseling, mental health counseling, just basic care suffered terribly in the health care arena for working people, the young people who are making $8, $12 an hour. They were stuck between, I can't afford insurance, affordable care says I have to have insurance. They went without insurance, and then they got penalized on their taxes.
Okay. Yep.
And they somehow blame Obama for that.
Yeah.
And now we have a layer of people with... Go ahead.
Marcia, I just want to say, you've brought up something that I didn't ask Philip about that I want to. So I want to take what you said about the Medicaid money back to Philip. That turned out to be a pretty interesting issue in some other states. Philip, how did it play in Wisconsin? Marsha's right in her assessment of how Walker handled that.
Yeah, I think, well, again, I think the nuance around healthcare is more sort of something that we think about as sort of people sort of looking on these elections. But you look at something like the exit polling on most important issue.
Yeah.
41% of Wisconsinites said that healthcare was the most important issue.
Mm-hmm.
And at least according to the exit poll, they went for Democrats by about 75%. So the Democrats did a really good job nationally of making healthcare the issue. And I think what we're also seeing nationally is we look at these ballot initiatives to expand Medicare coverage, and they're passing in states like Nebraska, right? States that you don't think of as particularly liberal in any way. And so this is, you know, a pretty standard, what we call thermostatic public opinion in political science, that when you have Republicans or conservatives in power, policy moves liberal, and vice versa. When you have Democrats or liberals in power, policy preferences among the public move conservative. And so I think that this is sort of a natural outgrowth of the way that we know public opinion moves in response to who's in power.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about health care on this show for quite a while. Bell says, I voted blue all the way down the ballot. Health care reform is my top priority. And a close second is holding Trump's negative agenda at bay. And then another listener says, I'm a dad who lives in Minneapolis. My son has a pre-existing condition. I'm doing my best to make sure he's protected. Would have voted the same way regardless because I have moral imagination and believe everybody deserves protection. I'm interested, Phil, in what you think happens now. I mean, towards the end of the campaign, we actually heard the president saying things like, it's the Democrats that want to take away your pre-existing condition. I mean, I don't think most voters bought that.
Mm-hmm.
But now what happens, do you think, with health care policy now that the House is Democratic?
I mean, I think we're going to see, unfortunately, more stalemate.
Really?
With a divided House and Senate and a Republican president, I don't think that we're going to see a lot of movement on this. I don't see that we might see some common ground between Democrats and Republicans in Congress, but I think the acrimony and the partisanship that we've seen is going to be difficult to overcome.
A call here from Dallas in Wayzata. Dallas, I only have like 2 minutes. Can you keep it short?
You know, I hope we can talk more about the successful candidates who focused on positive and exclusive and inclusive campaigns
mm-hmm.
and passed up the special interest and PAC money that so often makes divisive politics.
Yeah.
You know, the Dean Phillips campaign for U.S. House was, you know, that was their main theme.
Yeah.
And even
he
Kelly
had a lot
Morrison
of money,
in the,
though.
In the
I mean,
state house.
Yeah.
He did, but he had a huge group of volunteers who were motivated by his different way of doing politics.
Okay.
And there's not enough people doing it without the money, and the money changes everything.
It's a good point. We had a pretty good conversation a couple weeks ago about how these candidates take in the money and how the money gets spent and where it comes from and why it isn't transparent. One of the things I find, Philip, is that our listeners are really educated and knowledgeable about this. And I think even if it doesn't turn up on your top three issues of why you vote, you care. Many of our listeners care a lot about how this works in politics. What's your assessment?
My assessment on the issue of money in politics is that we see a pretty strong asymmetry. I think that Democrats especially care about this, and you've seen this in that a lot of Democrats running for Congress were able to say, I'm refusing PAC money.
I think Beto O'Rourke did too,
money.
Didn't he?
What?
Didn't Beto O'Rourke also say that in Texas?
Yep.
Yeah,
he did. And I think this is the start of, I think, the sort of polarization around the issue of campaign finance. You can think back to you know, the McCain-Feingold Act, which was this, you know, bipartisan agreement. And we've come a long way, and we've become more divided as a country on the issue of campaign finance than we were even, you know, 15 years ago. I'm on a lot of issues. And so I think we're still seeing an asymmetry. I think that this is a much stronger motivator for Democrats, Democratic voters, than it is for Republican voters.
Philip, thank you so much for being so flexible this morning, and really a pleasure to have you on the show. And I hope we'll talk again often before 2020.
All right.
Philip Chen with us from Beloit College in Wisconsin. More special coverage ahead.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.